Floyd Nation, which has been impoverished and demonized, with the hope that the Haitian people will ultimately get what they deserve. Until next time, I'm Marzia Hashemi for Hidden Files.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Of our speedboat, symbol of Iran's advancement in maritime defense technology. The Republic of Iran has made huge strides in manufacture of military hardware and equipment, including naval systems and weaponry for the Iranian Navy and the IRGC Navy. The modern and well-equipped naval forces of the Islamic Republic of Iran are able to provide the security of the Sea of Oman, the Persian Gulf, and the Strait of Hormuz. In this program, we're going to talk about Iran's rapid advancement in manufacture of defense systems and military hardware, including maritime weapon systems and the Zulfaqar speedboat in particular. Please stay with us. The commanding officer of the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps Navy, Rear Admiral Elazar Tangsiri, has emphasized that lasting security in the Persian Gulf and the Strait of Hormuz is the red line of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and that this red line will never be compromised under any circumstances. The top admiral of the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps Navy also talked about Iran's successes in recent years, in manufacturing a formidable array of naval equipment and weaponry, including a new generation of speedboats, intelligent or smart submarines, cruise missiles, and underground missile depots the size of a town or small city. Rear Admiral Elazar Tangsiri also discussed the role of speedboats in asymmetrical warfare. He said, as part of the IRGC's strategy for asymmetrical warfare, speedboats fitted with anti-ship missiles, rockets and torpedoes play a special role. The Navy of the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, IRGC, has made a lot of progress in recent years and is one of the best-equipped navies in the region, possessing a variety of missile-launching ships, speedboats, maritime cruise missiles, naval helicopters, etc. Since the beginning of the formation of the IRGC Navy, high-speed vessels have been the main priority of this force in the field of surface combat, and during the past years, newer models of high-speed missile-launching vessels have entered the IRGC Navy combat structure. In fact, one of the most important components of combat superiority of the IRGC Navy is to have a significant number of famous speedboats of this force, such as the Zulfaqar speedboat, the Yarmahdi speedboat, Azarakh speedboat, and the Saraj 1 and 2 speedboats. The Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps Navy has recently taken delivery of 110 missile-launching speedboats, new additions to the IRGC Navy's fleet, which includes the Zulfaqar speedboat. The home-manufactured military vessels are highly maneuverable and can fire missiles and rockets. The new speedboats will be employed by the IRGC naval forces for various operations in the Sea of Oman and in the Persian Gulf. IRGC Naval Commander Rear Admiral Eleazar Tangsiri said the velocity of the new military boats has been increased from 55 knots to 75 knots and to 90 knots, and is expected to reach 110 knots in the next stage of development. All equipment installed on the speedboats, including the missiles, rockets and radar systems, have been developed by Iranian scientists and engineers working for Iran's defense industries in collaboration with high-tech knowledge-based companies. The top admiral of the IRGC Navy, Eleazar Tangsiri, added, "The length of the Zulfaqar speedboat is about 16 meters. Its width is about 4 meters. The height of its column is about 1 meter. It can carry payloads of up to 14 tons. It is fitted with two diesel engines which give it a top speed of 52 knots, about 97 kilometers per hour. The Zulfaqar speedboat's operational range is 320 nautical miles, which is about 576 kilometers. The speedboat is fitted with two heavy-duty 12.7mm machine guns, one in front and one in rear of the boat, and it is also fitted with anti-ship Kothar missiles, with an effective range of 25 kilometers. The new generation of Zulfaqar speedboats are fitted with the NAS-1 missiles, and the older generation is fitted with the Kothar missiles. They're also capable of carrying 107 and 122mm rockets. It is also equipped with cutting-edge state-of-the-art electronic warfare technology."
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Last week, the UN Human Rights Council convened a meeting at the request of Germany and Iceland to discuss alleged human rights violations in Iran during the handling of recent riots in the country. The intergovernmental body voted to establish an independent international fact-finding mission to investigate the purported abuses. In reaction, Tehran has dismissed the move. Iran's foreign ministry said the country will not cooperate with the mission, stressing that it has already formed a national fact-finding committee to look into the events. Spokesman Nasser Kanani made the remarks at a press briefing in the Iranian capital of Tehran, as he showed up with a chemical mask in the presser, which alluded to Germany's support for Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein during the 1980 to 1988 Iraqi-imposed war on Iran. Kanani lashed out at Germany for co-sponsoring the anti-Iran resolution at the Geneva-based council, saying Germany is the same country that supplied chemical weapons to the former Iraqi Ba'ath regime during the 1980s war with Iran. Official reports indicate that in 1980, under the rule of former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein, Baghdad purchased over 1,000 tons of mustard agents from the West, Germany, the US, the UK, Italy, and the Netherlands were among the countries providing the Ba'athist regime with equipment and material to build chemical weapons. Over 350 large-scale chemical attacks on Iran-Iraq border between 1980 to 1988 on soldiers and civilians left Iran with more than 100,000 victims. Tens of thousands died on the spot, and many more suffered for years as a result of exposure to chemical agents. Elsewhere in his remarks, the spokesman of Iran's foreign ministry underlined that several United Nations reports have pointed to the fact that German companies were supplying the former Iraqi regime with chemical weapons. Kanani also condemned the hasty employment of human rights mechanisms and instrumental use of them against independent states, emphasizing that such an approach will not provide any help for the advancement of human rights. The Iranian Foreign Ministry has summoned German ambassador to Tehran after the UN Human Rights Council convened a meeting at the request of Berlin and passed a resolution against the Islamic Republic. The ministry conveyed Tehran's strong protest against the interventionist and baseless statements of German authorities to the ambassador. Tehran denounced the recent passage of an anti-Iranian resolution at the UN Human Rights Council over the recent developments in Iran as a wrong measure founded on a completely politicized and instrumental approach to human rights, which is categorically rejected. The collaboration of Germany and certain European countries with the unilateral coercive measures imposed by the U.S. has resulted in violation of the human rights of Iranians and strips them of any legitimacy and competence to make claims about human rights advocacy. Earlier in November, Tehran summoned the German ambassador over interventionist and irresponsible comments by the European country's head of state, Olaf Scholz, in support of the recent Western-instigated riots in Iran. Tehran blames foreign provocations for the riots in the country, saying it has provided evidence to countries whose nationals were involved in inciting unrest. The rioters have been going on a rampage across the country, attacking security forces, resorting to vandalism against public property, and desecrating religious sanctities. Earlier in the month, Iran's intelligence ministry said the United States and the United Kingdom were directly involved in the recent riots, adding that dozens of terrorists affiliated with the Zionist regime and anti-revolution groups have also been detained in the unrest. The European Union and some Western countries imposed sanctions on Iran over its approach toward the riots. Iran, in turn, announced retaliatory sanctions against institutions and individuals in the European Union due to their deliberate actions in support of terrorism and terrorist groups during the riots.
More people will die in Europe this winter because of energy costs than those who have perished on the battlefield in the Ukraine war. That's according to a research conducted by the British weekly newspaper The Economist. The research said the current cost of energy will likely lead to an extra 147,000 deaths if there is a typical winter. The British newspaper modeled the impact of a sharp increase in electricity prices in Europe on deaths during the winter. In case of mild temperatures using the warmest winter during the past 20 years for each country, this figure would fall to 79,000, and with frigid ones using each country's coldest winter since 2000, it would climb to 185,000. The analysis named the severity of the flu season and temperatures and energy prices as the main factors that affect how many people will die in Europe outside Ukraine this winter. The model forecasts deaths based on weather, demography, influenza, energy efficiency, incomes, government spending, and electricity costs, which are closely correlated to prices for a wide variety of heating fuels. Italy is predicted to have the most deaths, owing to a nearly 200% rise in electricity costs since 2020, and a big aging population. According to The Economist statistics, across Europe, 28% more people aged at least 80, who account for 49% of total mortality, die in the coldest months than in the warmest ones. On average, in a winter 1 Celsius degree colder than normal for a given country, 1.2% more people die. High fuel prices can exacerbate the effect of low temperatures and deaths by deterring people from using heat and raising their exposure to cold. Given average weather, the model finds that a 10% rise in electricity prices is associated with a 0.6% increase in deaths, though this number is greater in cold weeks and smaller in mild ones. The report notes that due to Russian attacks on its infrastructure, Ukraine would suffer more civilian casualties than any other country in the model. Last week, European Commissioner for Economy Paolo Gentiloni warned that if the Ukraine war doesn't end by the time next winter hits, Europe's energy sector will face more serious risks than this year. As a result of increasing Western sanctions on Russia, the price of gas and electricity for residential houses in Europe has increased significantly. Before the war, Russia supplied 40 to 50% of the European Union's natural gas. Russian Foreign Ministry spokesperson Maria Zakharova blamed European officials for the energy crisis and lack of fuel in Europe. She said the European leaders are forced to convince their citizens that the current situation is not only good and right, but also in their own interest. The G7, including the United States as well as the entire EU plus Australia, has stepped up attempts in recent days to impose a punitive price cap on seaborne exports of Russian oil on December 5th, as part of sanctions against Moscow over its military operation in Ukraine that began on February 24th. Russian President Vladimir Putin has warned of grave consequences to the US-led scheme of introducing price caps on Russian crude oil, as the European Union nations failed to agree on a price ceiling. Around 70 to 85% of Russia's crude exports are carried by tankers rather than pipelines. And the idea of a price cap spearheaded by Washington is to ban shipping, insurance, and reinsurance companies from handling cargoes of Russian crude oil across the world unless it is sold at or below the price set by the G7 and its allies. Since the onset of the conflict, the United States and its European allies have imposed waves of economic sanctions against Moscow, while supplying large consignments of heavy weaponry to Kyiv. The Kremlin says the sanctions and the supplies will prolong the war.
It was an important forum comprised of volunteer forces that have been at the forefront in confronting the rioters, the all-too-important besieged force, which throughout the decades have not only served in the security arena, have contributed to Iran's advancements in a host of fields like science and technology. Iran's leader, in his address to them for the occasion of Besiege Week, said that these forces have sacrificed themselves in order to save people from a bunch of rioters and mercenaries. But he also advised them on who the real enemy is, that in the bigger picture, Iran's battle is not with a group of rioters, but with global hegemony. The onslaught on Iran, especially through the media, has been organized by foreign actors, like from Saudi Arabia and the UK. With US and Israel aiding and abetting their fake news, the primary goal has been to create unrest inside of Iran by inviting Iranians to come out and protest. At the same time, there are some under the misguided belief that talking to the U.S. will solve Iran's problems.
I've been notified that the U.S. president has said that he's seeking to free Iran. Mr. President, Iran was freed 43 years ago and is determined not to get subjugated. And Iran will never be your milking cow.
But Iran's leader has said that negotiating will not resolve anything, saying that our problem with America can only be resolved by letting that country hold us to ransom. There have been lots of speculations as to why the riots began in the first place, especially the timing, which came when the JCPOA sanctions removal talks with world powers were deadlocked over Washington's lack of commitment. It is a distinct possibility that the recent riots may have been part of the West's pressure on Iran to compromise on its rights in negotiations, including with the U.S. Yet the whole notion on continuing with these talks is not in the best interest of Iran and can never bear fruit due to the West and U.S.'s excessive demands. Realistically, the U.S. wants Iran to abandon its nuclear program, to change its constitution, restrict its influence to inside of its borders, and to close its defense industries, basically stripping the country of its identity. Some of these restrictions and excessive demands are due to Israel, which acts in line with U.S. policies to maintain dominance over the region. After all, the U.S. has worked hard to vilify Iran through Iranophobia in the region, pushing Persian Gulf Arab countries to normalize ties with Israel to unite against regional power, Iran. That is one of the reasons that Iran has time and again said that the U.S. must leave the West Asia region, as it only seeks to weaken and ultimately disintegrate Muslim countries, as stated by advisor to Iran's leader, Ali Akbar Velayati. The U.S. has played a destructive role in the region, like pushing hard for the partitioning of Iraq and Syria, trying to do the same with Iran. This has been a goal of the U.S., a West Asia region whose borders can be redrawn to their liking, with the ultimate goal of having vassal states serving U.S. interests. But when it comes to Iran, that will be an impossible feat. One only has to look at the most recent showing of Iranians when it came to their large-scale presence earlier this month during pro-government demonstrations, and for the funeral of Iranian commander Qasem Soleimani, whom the U.S. assassinated back in 2020 from a drone strike in Baghdad. Not to mention the funeral processions which Iranians participated in, the funerals held in Karaj, Isfahan, and Shiraz.
Itamar Ben-Gvir, a far-right member of the Israeli Knesset, has called for the extrajudicial executions. He is now to become Israel's Minister of National Security, giving him much more power than he had before. That power is quickly turning into a tool for him to pursue his extremist anti-Arab agendas. Just to put the extremism into perspective, Ben-Gvir and his allies hope to grant total immunity to Israeli soldiers who shoot at Palestinians and also impose the death penalty on Palestinians who attack Jewish people. For even more perspective, he made the headlines just before the Israeli elections as he called on the police to shoot Palestinian stone throwers as he held a pistol in his hand. Now being in charge of the Ministry of National Security, he has the power to implement his racist agendas that he's been advocating for years. Ben-Gvir's far-right party is called Otzma Yehudit, which translates into Jewish power. This party also has been fittingly called Kahanist and anti-Arab. Kahanist because the members of this party owe a lot of their racist ideologies to a racist rabbi by the name of Meir Kahane. He had called for a ban on Arab-Jewish intermarriage, as well as mass expulsion of Palestinians. His ideas were, in fact, so repugnant that the U.S. listed his party as a terrorist group, and he was even banned from Israeli parliament, the Knesset. He was unsurprisingly assassinated by an Arab in 1990. His ideologies, however, live on, as Itamar Ben-Gvir recently paid his tribute at an annual memorial still held to this date to revive the Otzma Yehudit party's pledge of allegiance to the slain Jewish supremacist rabbi.
He never since disowned Rabbi Meir Kahane or his legacy. In this passive regard, he's part of that racist legacy, but he was never caught saying anything like that publicly himself. That is why he remains within the political arena, and in recent years also much more firmly within it.
While Ben-Gvir was booed by the audience for saying, "I am not Rabbi Kahane and I do not support the deportation of all Arabs," he did also say, "Ultimately, Rabbi Kahane was about love. Love for Israel without compromise, without any other consideration." He was cheered later for vowing to expel what he called terrorists from Israel. With his newfound power alongside Benjamin Netanyahu and his Likud party, Israel is expected to have its most religious cabinet to date, which in Zionist terms means the most extremist Israeli administration to date. We know that tensions are going to be heightened with the installment of Ben-Gvir from his most recent visit to the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the city of Al-Quds. During his visit, protected by Israeli police, he shouted that we are the masters of the house here, almost to provoke a response from Palestinians. But Palestine isn't scared. Israel, however much it tries to portray itself as an impenetrable fortress, has never known peace since the occupation began in 1948. Even though it has struck normalization deals with certain Arab nations, trying to dethrone the issue of Palestine as the number one concern in the Muslim world, and even though it is backed to the hilt by the US and EU, whether politically or militarily, Israel is far from the safe haven it likes to portray itself as being. What has been happening in the occupied West Bank with Israel's efforts to repress protests with brutal violence indicates that the Palestinian liberation struggle is entering a new phase when once extremist fringe settlers are now seeing themselves represented at the top levels of Israeli administrations and are backed by the police. They become emboldened and extremely brash and out of control. Neighborhoods in Al-Quds have seen Palestinians burning tires and dumpsters and throwing firecrackers at raiding Israeli forces and even lighting police vehicles on fire. The complete immunity of Israel and the empty gestures by international bodies is pushing Palestinians into a full-scale revolt, a third intifada perhaps. If that were to happen, Israel's luck might just run out this time in their effort to save face on the international sphere, and if they do lose face, the conflict will take a very different shape.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In the U.S., the city of San Francisco in California will allow police officers to deploy robots that kill. The Democratic San Francisco Board of Supervisors voted to allow police to use potentially lethal, remote-controlled robots in emergency situations. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Associated Press has covered this story and gives us more details. Police in San Francisco will be allowed to deploy potentially lethal remote-controlled robots in emergency situations. The controversial policy was approved after weeks of scrutiny and a heated debate among the city's Board of Supervisors during their meeting on Tuesday, 29th of November. Police oversight groups, the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, and San Francisco's public defender has urged the 11-member body to reject the police's use of equipment proposal. Opponents of the policy said it would lead to further militarization of a police force already too aggressive with underserved communities. They said the parameters under which use would be allowed were too vague. Supporters of the scheme argued that having these robots as an option in dangerous situations was necessary, given what they see as an ever-increasing risk of a high-profile shooting hitting the city. The policy was approved with an amendment that specifies the circumstances in which robots can be used, and clarifying that only high-ranking police officers will be allowed to authorize the use of deadly force. "I'm surprised that we're here in 2022, said Hillary Ronan, one of the supervisors at the Tuesday's meeting. Hillary Ronan added, "We have seen a history of these leading to tragedy and destruction all over the world." The San Francisco Police Department said that it had owned and used robots for tasks such as serving warrants for 11 years, and that the department did not have pre-armed robots and had no plans to arm robots with guns. But the police department could deploy robots equipped with explosive charges in specific situations, such as active shooter incidents and suicide bombers, said David Lazar, San Francisco's assistant police chief. David Lazar added, "We have it as a tool we can use if we have time, have secured the scene, and we weigh out if we want to risk lives or if we send a robot." San Francisco's assistant police chief David Lazar invoked the 2017 mass shooting incident during a country music festival in Las Vegas, Nevada, as an example of the kind of situation that could necessitate the use of a robot equipped with explosives. Opposing supervisors argued that the mention of the mass casualty was a scare tactic meant to get a rubber stamp on tools that could be disproportionately used against low-income Black and Latino residents of San Francisco. According to a San Francisco Chronicle analysis, Black people were nearly six times more likely to be stopped by police than white residents in 2020. "I can't believe what I'm hearing. These kinds of tools will deepen the disparities in inflicting deadly force on communities," said Dean Preston, a supervisor who represents San Francisco's long-troubled Tenderloin neighborhood. The proposed policy does not lay out specifics for how the weapons can and cannot be equipped, leaving open the option to arm them. Robots will only be used as a deadly force option when risk of loss of life to members of the public or police officers is imminent and outweighs any other force option available to the San Francisco Police Department, it says. The vote comes under a new California state law that requires police and sheriff's departments to inventory military-grade equipment and seek approval for its use. San Francisco police currently have a dozen functioning ground robots used to assess bombs to provide eyes in low-visibility situations, the department says. They were acquired between 2010 and 2017. The state law was authored last year by the San Francisco City Attorney, David Chu, while he was an assembly member. It is aimed at giving the public a forum and voice in the acquisition and use of military-grade weapons that have a negative effect on communities, according to the legislation. ABC News has also covered the same story. Supervisors in San Francisco, California, voted on Tuesday, 29th of November, to give city police the ability to use potentially lethal remote-controlled robots in emergency situations, but not until after an emotionally charged debate that reflected divisions on the politically liberal board over support for law enforcement. The vote was 8-3, with the majority agreeing to grant police the option, despite strong objections from civil liberties groups and other police oversight groups. Opponents said the authority would lead to the further militarization of a police force already too aggressive with poor and minority communities. Supervisor Connie Chan, a member of the committee that forwarded the proposal to the full board, said she understood concerns over use of force, but that, according to state law, we're required to approve the use of these equipments. So here we are, and it's definitely not an easy discussion. The San Francisco Police Department said it does not have pre-armed robots and has no plans to arm robots with guns. But the department could deploy robots equipped with explosive charges to contact, incapacitate, or disorient violent, armed, or dangerous suspects when lives are at stake. The San Francisco Police Department spokesperson Allison Maxey said in a statement, "Robots equipped in this manner would only be used in extreme circumstances to save or prevent further loss of innocent lives," she said. Supervisors amended the proposal on Tuesday to specify that police officers could use robots only after using alternative force or de-escalation tactics, or concluding they would not be able to subdue the suspect through those alternative means. Only a limited number of high-ranking officers could authorize use of robots as a deadly force option. San Francisco police currently have a dozen functioning ground robots used to assess bombs or provide eyes in low-visibility situations. They were acquired between 2010 and 2017, and not once have they been used to deliver an explosive device, police officials have emphasized. But explicit authorization was required after a new California law went into effect this year, requiring police and sheriff departments to inventory military-grade equipment and seek approval for their use. The state law was authored last year by San Francisco City Attorney David Chu, while he was an assembly member. It is aimed at giving the public a forum and voice in the acquisition and use of military-grade weapons that have a negative effect on communities, according to their new legislation. A federal program has long dispensed grenade launchers, camouflage uniforms, bayonets, armored vehicles, and other surplus military equipment to help local law enforcement. In 2017, then-President Donald Trump signed an order reviving the Pentagon program after his predecessor Barack Obama curtailed it in 2015, triggered in part by outrage over the use of military gear during protests in Ferguson, Missouri, after the shooting death of Michael Brown. San Francisco police said late on Tuesday, 29th of November, that no robots were obtained from military surplus, but some were purchased with federal grant money. Like many places around the United States, San Francisco is trying to balance public safety with treasured civilian rights such as privacy and the ability to live free of excessive police oversight. In September of this year, supervisors agreed to a trial run allowing police to access, in real time, private surveillance camera feeds in certain circumstances.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترك همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Current world order will be replaced by a new order where US is isolated, Asia powerful, resistance front expanded. This is the part of a speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution during a meeting with students on Wednesday, November 2nd, 2022. This meeting was held on the occasion of National Students' Day and National Day of Fighting Against Global Arrogance, which are commemorated on the 13th of Aban 4th of November. The enemy is busy making plans. Like I said, our officials need to feel responsible. They need to know why the enemy is sensitive about a certain word, a certain name, and why they keep banning it. They need to know why the enemy keeps publishing so many lies on social media. They need to resolve this and deal with it. This is the responsibility of our officials. You young people also have a duty. You need to feel responsible as well in order to distinguish the truth from lies. I believe it can be done. It is not impossible. They want to ingrain certain things using large volumes with repetition in the minds of the youth, but you can tell whether this contradicts reality or not, distinguishing the truth from lies and distortions. Secondly, be wary of those who are of the same opinion as the enemy. Guide them. I'm not saying you should fight with them, but guide them. Explain things to them.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
There are people who agree with the enemy, although it is not intentional. Some do not understand. They are uninformed. One can see how certain individuals are saying things on social media or written things in newspapers. These people are not antagonists. They have just misunderstood things. These individuals need to be guided. The best person who can guide them is you, young people. Write to them, talk to them, send them messages, explain things, and reason with them in your gatherings. Of course, we know that dealing with these issues should be planned. The events that occurred these past few weeks were not merely street riots. They were detailed plots. The enemy initiated hybrid warfare. The enemy, namely the United States, the Zionist regime, some insidious and malicious European powers, and some groups came to the scene with all of their capabilities.
You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
A
What has been highlighted in Doha, Qatar, is that despite a few Arab rulers and monarchies normalizing ties with the fabricated regime of Israel, the people of those countries are against any form of normalization with the regime. The reality is there would have been no normalization if the people of these monarchies have the right to voice their opinion on such controversial matters. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Tehran Times wrote, with the World Cup in Qatar well underway, the regime occupying Palestine saw an opportunity to try and further extend its occupying hand toward the Arab and Islamic world. But events at the world's most popular sporting event have painted a completely different picture, such as the disgust toward Israeli regime policies at the prestigious occasion that even reporters dispatched by the apartheid regime have been investigating and reporting on the cup of hatred towards Israelis on the streets of Doha. The reporter speaks of the dangers for Israelis in Qatar and how they have been exposed to enemies from all sides. If the Zionist regime had any hopes for a thaw in ties, it was mistaken. Instead, soccer fans, in particular Arabs, at the first World Cup in West Asia, are steering well clear of Israeli journalists in Qatar, who have been trying to interview them in an attempt to send some attractive headlines to the war criminals in Israeli-occupied Palestinian territories. Before the event even kicked off, the Zionist regime officials had expressed hope that the so-called U.S.-brokered Abraham Accords reached with the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain in 2020 and later Sudan and Morocco would inspire further normalization, with a lot of that hope pinned on one of the region's influential players, Saudi Arabia. But the scenes have illustrated the challenges facing the wider Israeli ambitions 2 years after some Persian Gulf states forged formal ties with the occupation. Attempts to try and even interview some Arab fans have fallen flat, with the Zionist reporters from the regime's biggest news broadcasters saying they were being snubbed, reflecting the strong boycott and oppression by the people of the rulers of Arab and Islamic countries that normalized ties over the past 2 years. Footage has gone viral online showing how Saudis, Qataris, and Lebanese fans, among others, walking away from Israeli reporters. One Israeli reporter said Palestinian fans held an impromptu protest next to him, waving their flags and chanting "Go home," in reference to the European and American countries from which Israeli settlers migrated to Palestine over the past decades, prompting the brutal Zionist ethnic cleansing campaigns against the native Palestinians. On the other hand, the widespread support for the oppressed Palestinian people has been displayed, with Palestinian flags being waved inside and outside the stadiums, despite the fact that Palestine did not qualify for the tournament. Fans from many Arab and Islamic countries have carried Palestinian flags prominently at matches and worn them as capes around their necks. In another case of the sheer disgust toward the Zionist regime among the Arab world, Israeli media have reported that a Qatari taxi driver kicked one of the apartheid regime's journalists out of his taxi after he discovered the reporter was an Israeli. According to Israeli media, the driver refused to accept the reporter's money because they killed his Palestinian brothers. The Israeli journalist added, "He dropped me in the middle of nowhere, said he wouldn't take money because we kill his brothers and all that stuff." The Zionist journalist also claims that security guards were sent to remove him and his filming crew from a Qatari beach. The report says security guards were sent to remove him and his filming crew from a Qatari beach after he asked a local restaurant to film on his premises. The owner asked to know where we are from. He called for security guards to escort us away after finding out we were Israeli, the journalist said. The restaurant beach owner also took the journalist's phone, demanding he deletes every photo taken in his restaurant. The reporter claimed, "I felt threatened." One video circulating online shows an Egyptian football fan smiling serenely as an Israeli broadcaster introduces him live on air. Then he leans into the microphone with a message, "Viva Palestine." Another clip that has gone viral from the streets of Doha recently shows a group of Lebanese men walking away from a live interview with a reporter after they learned he is Israeli. One shouts over his shoulder, "There is no Israel, it's Palestine." While neither the Israeli occupying regime nor Palestine is playing in the tournament, Palestine has featured prominently in West Asia's first World Cup. During the opening ceremony before the first match, a phalanx of Qatari men came to the Al Bayt Stadium chanting, "Everyone is welcome," carrying with them a large Palestinian flag. "We are taking care of people in Palestine, and all Muslim people and Arab countries are holding up Palestinian flags because we are for them," the flag bearer told the media. One Israeli man, who gave only his first name, told the Guardian newspaper, "The majority of the masses here do not accept the presence of Israelis." The Zionist regime officials have posted videos urging their settler entity fans to keep a low profile. "The Iranian team will be in the World Cup, and we estimate that tens of thousands of fans will follow it. And there will be other fans from Persian Gulf countries that we don't have diplomatic relations with," said Lior Hayat, a senior Zionist regime official, adding, "Downplay your Israeli presence and Israeli identity for the sake of your personal security," addressing Israeli fans. He also expressed hope of a positive, hassle-free Israeli presence in Qatar that would advance the Zionist regime's ambitions to further integrate into the region after the normalization deals with two of Doha's Persian Gulf neighbors. Hayat said, "We very much hope things will go smoothly." With the extent of so many other incidents involving Zionist settlers going viral at the tournament, it appears that things are not going as smoothly as the Zionist regime official had anticipated. It also shows the immense show of solidarity with Palestinians and the resentment toward Israeli regime war crimes and massacres against children. Qataris themselves have a history of support for the Palestinian cause. More importantly, what has been highlighted in Doha is that despite a few Arab rulers and monarchies normalizing ties with the fabricated regime of Israel, the people of those countries are against any form of normalization with the regime. Over the years, there has been a growing boycott of athletes from different sporting events, boycotting matches against Israeli opponents at fixtures in protest against the apartheid regime. This is while Palestinian flags have been waved in matches involving even Western teams who play the Zionist regime, perhaps most notably in the stands at Celtic Park in Scotland. This is despite rules introduced by the UK authorities to ban Palestinian flags inside the stadium in the Scottish city of Glasgow. At times, entire sections of fans at Glasgow Celtic's stadium displayed Palestinian flags to protest Israeli regime occupation. During games against Israeli teams, Scottish fans turned whole sections of the stadium into a sea of Palestinian flags, ignoring the official ban. Demonstrations for Palestine in Scottish football matches have been organised by several groups, including one that usually posts on social media platforms the words "Fly the flag for Palestine, for Celtic, for justice." The group's creators have also called on Celtic fans to support the Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions Movement, BDS, saying that people should express their democratic rights to display our opposition to Israeli apartheid, settler colonialism and countless massacres of the Palestinian people.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Aruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
A chill has fallen on relations between Moscow and the Vatican City. The rift has been sparked by an interview published in a U.S. magazine on Monday in which the head of the Catholic Church, Pope Francis, condemned, quote, the cruelty of some minority groups of soldiers, namely the Chechens and the Siberian Buryats, in the Ukraine's conflict. On Tuesday, Moscow's ambassador to the Vatican, Alexander Avdiiv, lodged an official complaint in response. Pope Francis' remarks were made during an interview with America, a Jesuit magazine headquartered in New York. When asked about his apparent reluctance to directly condemn Russia for the war in Ukraine, the pontiff said in response that he received much information about the cruelty of the troops. The Russian ambassador to the Holy See, Avdiiv, expressed anger at the pontiff's, quote, insinuation of alleged atrocities by the Russian military during the course of the special military operation in Ukraine. The ambassador also stressed that nothing can shake the cohesion and unity of the multinational Russian people. The Russian Foreign Ministry also dismissed Pope Francis' comments.
What will the Vatican tell us about the martyrdom of the multinational Soviet people? Maybe it makes sense to first discuss Catholic penance for the 20th century for the Orthodox and for Muslims for the many centuries before that. This is no longer Russophobia. It's a perversion of the truth on a level I can't even name.
Earlier this week, Moscow had welcomed the Vatican's announcement of mediation to bring an end to the Russian-Ukrainian war. Some fear that this could no longer be viable after this diplomatic incident.
I don't think this tense moment will change the Vatican-Russia relations substantially. Moscow still expects the Holy See to position itself as a mediator in the conflict with Ukraine. But whether the mediation takes off will very much depend on Kiev and largely on the U.S.
On Sunday, top Vatican diplomat Archbishop Paul Richard Gallagher had said the Holy See and Pope Francis are ready to provide space for peace negotiations on Ukraine. However, after the announcement, Moscow said Kiev is against any peace talks. Max Civili, Rome.
In the United States, many spent their Thanksgiving holiday not in gratitude, but in grief, as mass shootings and violent crime continue to plague the nation. Many are lost in confusion, trying to explain why there have been over 600 mass shootings so far this year, a pace just below the all-time record. In only Chicago, the nation's third largest city, 8 people were killed and at least 30 wounded by gun violence over the holiday weekend.
Everybody's always talking about how dangerous this city is, how unreasonable it is to live in America because of how much crime there is. Crime rates are actually about the same. What changes is how much funding are we getting? How many schools are closing? How many resources do people have? And when you actually don't actually invest in this with a growing population, that's of course going to cause more crime.
The Democratic Party is about to hand over control of the House of Representatives, and they are being widely criticized for refusing to pass stricter gun laws when they had the chance. Republicans are likely to defend gun ownership, and they eked out a midterm legislative victory with a major emphasis on violent crime.
No matter what grievance.